every company that we now invest in is either AI native or AI accelerated.
That's Julie, the managing partner at Urban Innovation Fund, and they have over $200 billion in assets under management. They're based in San Francisco, and they're investing in the future of cities.
Hot take that we always have when evaluating AI startups is that we really want to see a line of sight to...
I want to help you grab the attention of VCs like Julie, so I ask this question.
If I'm a founder trying to reach out to you, what would the cold email look like?
Well, my email is julie@urbaninnovationfund.com. We do look at all of our cold emails, and we have invested in companies that have cold emailed us.
So that should fire you up. But I wanted to know, what actually should you put in the email?
Honestly, it's as easy as like, hey, here's what we do. Here's the exciting traction we have. A link to my...
So the email went well. Once you get the meeting, get ready for this.
I typically do ask for a product demo if they have a product within the first meeting. I really deeply want to understand what you've built, what you're...
You get the full details there, but you also get to hear how she talks to her partners about your startup after your meeting. This episode was recorded outside in front of the Ferry Building in San Francisco. Let's just say we had a lot of fun.
Can't believe we're out here braving the elements. It's the best.
Yes, I feel like we're doing a weather report.
I'm Adam O'Donnell. This is the Founder Initiative. Let's go.
If you had to distill a single trait that you looked for in a founder, of an early stage founder, like that correlates to success, what would that be?
What we have seen in terms of success is you have to be maniacal. And we mean that in the most positive way, but you have to be maniacally obsessed with execution. And there has to be a mania around it because it's so hard to bring something from nothing to real life.
I love that. How do you judge that in the early days? Like, what are some of the biggest signals?
You know, it's interesting. We are an investor that comes in at the pre-seed and seed. So our fund, the Urban Innovation Fund, investing in the future of cities, we always enter at the pre-seed and seed. And when we see entrepreneurs, typically there isn't a ton of revenue traction or even customer traction. But what we like to do is every time we meet a founder, we like to look at the progress that they've made, whether it be around product, whether it be around signups, whether it be around customer user testing. And I think showing really definitive signs of progress in between meetings, like I'll give an example. The first time I'll meet with a startup and, you know, they're kind of sketching out the product. Then they actually bring a demo about a week later. A couple days later, they've already tested it and maybe gotten some verbal interest, and then getting that to an LOI or something else to really indicate that someone wants to buy it. Yeah. I think those are all really exciting traits that get me pumped about following a founder, because it shows that they are maniacally obsessed with bringing their product and vision to life.
You only have one shot with an investor for the first impression. And a concern would be if you come too early, you're not ready. Even though what I'm hearing you say is like, hey, like maybe come even before that, and I want to see your progress versus you just tell me later.
You know, people have different schools of thoughts on it. I will say for us, one, it's never too early. Two, we currently have 70 portfolio companies across our funds. And of those 70 portfolio companies, there are at least 4 where we passed on the pre-seed and then they came back at the seed. And I was so impressed by their progress or traction or something else that was happening with their product that we ended up investing. And so I think building those relationships and showing tangible proof points around how you can execute, how you can build a great product, and how much traction you can have in a short period of time gets me really excited.
And that's what it's all about. Well, how is AI, like, how is that affecting your strategy? I mean, everyone's talking about it, blah, blah, blah. But like in what you've actually seen in terms of the companies that you're writing checks to.
You know, it's so interesting because now AI is everywhere. And the way that we think about it, AI is we're an outcomes-based fund. We want companies that are really transforming the ways that cities run and the way we live and how it shapes our built world. And AI is having a profound impact across the board, as you've seen. The way we think about companies, we kind of group them into 2 buckets. They're either AI native. So, you know, you could think of your LLMs, your other agentic type companies, or AI accelerated. And so there's a big chunk of our portfolio companies now that I would say are leveraging AI, whether it be through code writing, go to market, other elements to accelerate how fast they can move. And I think right now, pretty much every company falls into one of those 2 categories. We're really excited about the way AI has shaped urban tech and the way that it's transformed urban tech. One of our most recent companies is a company called Civic IQ. Essentially, they're a seed company where we led that round. And what they do is they take government data and they make it rapidly accessible in ways that, you know, going to government websites doesn't currently do. They're trying to build kind of like the modern day Bloomberg for government data. And they leverage a lot of AI to get information from things like video transcripts of town hall meetings, city, county meetings, et cetera. And so I think there's just so many practical use cases that are transforming the way that we can get access to things like government data. We're really pumped about AI. I would say in terms of pre-seed and seed investing, we're unlikely to invest in like an LLM OpenAI competitor, but we're really excited to see the applications that can be built atop of it or can leverage other AI use cases.
How do you look at defensibility with these, with just companies like that? I imagine, is it around the data set in like the example that you just made?
In the case of Civic IQ, it's definitely around the data set, but I think that is the bigger issue that everyone's asking right now, which is what is the competitive moat for a lot of these companies? Because one of the great things about AI is it's making work faster, easier, simpler. Building out certain products has been much faster as a result of AI, but that also means fast followers are going to come. And so we really have to believe on the vision from the founders, the way that they are setting themselves up to be kind of like a source of truth and system of record for many of their customers. And we have to deeply believe that they're going to be kind of that core workflow that people come back to. So I think that's the bet we've tried to make.
You've been doing this for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
Like with this fund.
So we launched the Urban Innovation Fund a little over 8 years ago. We have 3 funds now. We're currently investing out of our third, which is $121 million pre-seed fund.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a lot for a pre-seed.
It is. You know, and the good thing is we are writing bigger checks. We can lead, we can co-lead, we can be a really substantive syndicate partner, but we have deep conviction around every bet we make. And it means a lot to us. Every single company counts, and we, you know, roll up our sleeves. And I think many of our founders will say we are always accessible, always a phone call, text, WhatsApp away.
It's obviously competitive out there for great companies.
Yeah.
What's the biggest differentiator that you would say when you're pitching founders?
The Urban Innovation Fund, we invest in startups shaping the future of cities. We define that really expansively in terms of industry vertical. So I would say some of our more prolific areas are transportation and mobility, climate tech, prop tech in the built environment. But we also like to think expansively around areas like fintech, small business enablement, health. You know, we just run a very large gamut of industries. We always get involved early, pre-seed and seed. In addition to providing capital, we also like to emphasize that we're very active, hands-on investors, and we do place a special emphasis on regulatory support, since we've seen that be an area of need. Currently investing out of our third fund, $121 million pre-seed and seed fund, we make about 10 new investments each year, and our check sizes range from about $500K up to $3 million, but we can be pretty flexible there.
I want to get your pick your brain on just like where things are going to be in like the next 5 or 10 years.
One of the big things that is exciting to us is we always look at regulatory tailwinds as a great driver of success for funding companies at the right time and the right market moment. And so a good example I could give of that, in 2019, we led the seed round for a company called Electrify. They were essentially a software for the transition to electric vehicle fleets. And so they were a really interesting bet at the time because there was a big question mark around how fast we would actually see electric vehicles coming on the roads for these fleets. But we really had strong conviction because we saw the tailwinds coming from Europe, from Israel, from Canada, from California. And so we led that seed round. And in 2021, about a year and a half after our initial investment, they were acquired by Ford to serve as kind of the software backbone for their Ford Pro commercial fleet line. And so it was a really great example of when you can get in early and see some of those tailwinds, that's really an exciting place to be. And so for us, one of the things that we're focusing on now, we're definitely seeing some regulatory tailwinds when it comes to digitizing of the built world and the built environment. We're doing quite a bit in compliance as well, that very unsexy area that we like to think of as pre-consensus. And we're also doing quite a bit in onshoring and nearshoring in the U.S. because we think that there are some really strong tailwinds there as well.
It's almost like there's so much disruption in general that's happening in the government. Like, as one example, that it creates just things are happening faster.
In the past, we've definitely struggled with investing in startups that sell directly to government. It's been a really hard area. It tends to move pretty slowly. So I would say, you know, more than 95% of our portfolio is B2B or B2C in some way. But lately, we feel like there actually has been some momentum around selling directly to government. And one of our more recent investments, a company called Infilla, which essentially creates software tooling for planning departments, is a testament to that. And they've found a way to really create a great workflow that really leverages AI in a unique way. And city departments have responded really quickly and aggressively in a way that we haven't seen with a lot of traditional startups selling to government. And so we think there might be a lot of opportunity there.
So yeah, you're saying like on the city level, things are actually, in certain cases, are actually being purchased faster.
What we're seeing is a lot of startups that are emphasizing compliance or onshoring or doing things where you're thinking a little bit differently about the cost structure. And I think that's an interesting area of opportunity.
Is there an area of innovation that you're just like, man, we've been looking for companies, but we just haven't seen it?
You know, we've traditionally been a really bottoms-up based fund, meaning, you know, startups come to us and we've seen some of the strongest founders really experience a personal pain point in their community and their industry. Yeah. And they're, you know, maniacally driven to solve that. So it's hard because, you know, I would have never thought we would fund, you know, the next solar panel recycling facility, but someone came to us with that idea and it was a great founder and we're so glad we backed it. I would say we're very open-minded. One of the crazier companies that we invested in from a pitch perspective, we invested in a company called Clean Card, which is essentially trying to make cancer screening at home as easy as a pregnancy test. So basically That's using amazing. Biomarkers from urine to try to identify cancers early, cancers starting specifically with bladder in their case. And it was a pitch that required a lot of regulatory approval. They have to go through an FDA process, but the vision, the storytelling was so compelling and the founder backgrounds in synthetic biology and computer science really matched closely with what they were building. And so we came in and, you know, kind of led that seed round. They've since raised a Series A. You know, biotech is kind of out of vogue right now, but I think when you have a really great team and founders that have a vision that's very mission-driven and deep, there's a huge area of opportunity. So we're really excited about companies like that.
If you could think back to like the past three companies that you've invested in, and I'm curious, what were the source? Like, how did they come to you?
We actually track that pretty closely. We love working with angel investors who are really specific to certain areas or thematic areas based on either companies they founded or companies that they've invested in. And so the last three deals we've done, they were all angel investor referrals. And we love that because typically when we're coming in, the company hasn't raised institutional capital. And so we can kind of come in and be that first institutional check in the door. So any angels out there, we'd love to co-invest with you and we'd love to see what you're excited about. You know, I think a lot of angels come to the forefront because they end up advising a company, helping them think about, you know, early pitfalls in specific thematic areas. And so, you know, a lot of these are trusted advisors, early investors. And I think seeing what they get excited about and how they can help the company in the very early days, helps us gain conviction and meet these founders early, build up that rapport. And, you know, for us, we will invest in companies that we haven't met before, but also seeing those proof points around execution really does help build conviction for us as well.
I think founders think that it's about the thing that they're pitching at the early stage, when really that is important, but it's like 10% compared to who is this person in terms of their background.
You know, one of the big things that we look for more than we used to is evangelism from the founder. And, you know, the storytelling around the pitch and the narrative of what you're building is so important and crucial to us. And I think when we first launched the fund, our thinking was, you know, this is something that can be trained or coached, or, you know, there are lots of engineers, technical folks like diamonds in the rough that might not, you know, might be more comfortable on the technical side, but not necessarily being the face of the company. And what we've actually geared toward more now is this idea of, hey, how do you evangelize? Are you somebody who like really brings in people during the pitch? Investors, employees, you know, other folks that can be part of the vision. And I think it's one of those things that's really hard to teach and coach on. Certainly you can get better, but I would say we now index a lot more for that. Mm. And I know that founders can oftentimes find it frustrating to say like, hey, building a pitch deck takes a long time. And also going through the rigmarole of doing a bunch of these pitches takes a long time. But I actually think it brings a lot of clarity to the way you describe what you're building, the way you describe what you're recruiting for, the way you describe your value proposition to customers and potential employees. And so for us, it's actually now a non-negotiable to have a really strong pitch, vision, and story. And it's got to be something that really compels us to take the leap as investors. And our hope is that it could also translate, of course, to recruiting great employees and also, you know, selling to customers.
It's so basic, but it's just a good grounded like realization of like, go back to the basics.
Absolutely. And, you know, we pitch our own fund to LPs to invest in. And I think it's funny because we don't actually spend that much time on the deck, but we really try to spend a lot of time solidifying what we call like our minute long summary on what we do and why it's important. Because our feeling is that if you can't tell your story in a pithy way, it's very hard for people, especially in today's Zoom distracted world, to really pay attention. And so I would encourage founders to do that because sometimes I think it's a lot easier to be rambly and long-winded. And it's actually much harder to tell everybody what you do and why you're awesome in a minute. And we always tell our founders, like, you should be able to talk through the full pitch deck in 5 minutes. People do not like that. But I also think attention spans are pretty limited. And so you really got to try to knock people over the head in the first 5 minutes.
And be super. And so in that 5 minutes, that's no conversations with you. Cause I think there's a dissonance between what a pitch actually looks like and what we've seen on Shark Tank, you know, kind of thing. And it, for me, it's seems to be more of a conversation are the best ones, but you're suggesting.
I mean, I think it depends on the flavor of how the founder wants to take it. Certainly, like you can have some chit chat in the beginning, but at the end of the day, like the pitch is the founder or the founders telling the story. Like it shouldn't be about me or any other investor.
We're about to shift and double down on her perspectives on AI, but then we're going to go into what it actually takes for you to get a meeting with Urban Innovation Fund, and then not only that, get that check at the end.
Every company that we now invest in is either AI native or AI accelerated. And so we're really excited about that, but we want founders to be very smart about the way that they're positioning their products, because we do see a lot of like chatbots, agentic workflows, wrappers. And if you're going to do something like that, we really want it to have line of sight to being a source of truth for whatever company, enterprise, small business, consumer is using that product. And if you're just working in the background between a bunch of different systems, it makes it much harder to do that. And so I think the hot take that we always have when evaluating, you know, AI startups is that we really want to see a line of sight to being that source of truth, that system of record, if you will. And, you know, we want it to be embedded in workflows, certainly. But if you're just going between a Slack to another system, it can just be harder to rely on that as that source. And it feels like that is going to have a lot more fast followers.
And the fast follower thing is just, it's huge. It's like, it's because you were able to grow so fast. It's the same reason why everyone else could as well. And so you got to be the best one in the world to run in that direction.
Yeah. I mean, we will see. We're seeing so many interesting applications on AI, and we're seeing growth rates like we haven't before. You know, we see a lot of interesting application. A good example that I could give, we have a company in our portfolio called Variance. And essentially what they do is AI driven content moderation. So when you think about content moderation, a lot of it was done by humans, perhaps outsourced in areas like the Philippines. And you were essentially bubbling up spam, harmful content, IP infringement, things that are illegal on many of these platforms. And it was a very manual, time-driven process. And now variants will bubble up a lot of those spamful and other, you know, kind of policy violations really quickly using AI-driven materials. And they could tell it to a human moderator that can then look at like the most, you know, important, let's call it 2 to 5% of the content. And so it's a win-win for both, you know, just like business processes and also for the humans. So that way we can sift through a vast majority of the spam. They've seen a ton of traction. They have big logos. You know, this company didn't exist a year and a half ago, and now they have logos like Medium, GoFundMe, Redbubble, among others. So it's just a very cool application, and they're applying it to everything from social media to gaming companies. And I think it's going to make the internet a safer place. So I'm very excited about what I'm seeing. I'm seeing a lot of mission-driven founders who are extremely accelerated by AI.
100%. I love that. The last question is, if I'm a founder trying to reach out to you, what would the cold email look like? And I want to say this is not the best channel, but I'm just curious to understand what would get you so excited.
Yeah, well, my email is julie@urbaninnovationfund.com. We do look at all of our cold emails, and we have invested in companies that have cold emailed us. So
okay.
we're very open, and we're very open-minded. But I will tell you one thing that AI has not made better is the cold email outreach process. And you must be in the same way as well, but I now get so many AI generated pitches that are like completely off the mark and very poorly done. And so it actually shows something when someone writes like a thoughtful email. And honestly, it's as easy as like, hey, here's what we do. Here's the exciting traction we have. A link to my pitch deck or memo, whatever you have you. If you're interested, here's my Calendly. And I've set up meetings from those kind of things before. Keep it concise, keep it brief, but tell me why you're awesome in a couple sentences. And, you know, it very much might pique my or one of my teammates' interests.
I love that. Sorry for the, I think they're hawking to say bye to us.
Yeah.
That is so good. I'm loving this right now because you're saying the Calendly removes the friction. So you're not having to go back and forth. So you're like, okay, if I'm kind of interested, that's going to make it easier for me that way. And then you said traction and you said what you do. You didn't say anything about your own bio. I'm intrigued by that.
I mean, I don't think you need to prove that you know me or that we invested in whatever. I think the more important thing is just saying, hey, here's what I do. Here's why I'm awesome. Here's attraction. We're raising a pre-seed or seed. Link to my deck. And here's a Calendly if you're interested in scheduling. And I've definitely taken meetings like that. My teammates have taken meetings from that. And I think I am an efficiency person, meaning like we do a lot of meetings all the time. We love meeting founders. I love hearing stories, and I'm very passionate about hearing the why behind why a founder wants to build something and make it real. And it's a tough journey. And so I want to hear all the nitty gritty. And so if you can, you know, storytell in that email, I think clear writing is clear thinking, and that goes a long way.
What would that meeting look like? So you actually schedule the Calendly with me.
Yeah.
What's the first question you're going to ask?
Well, first I would introduce myself, and then I'd say, tell me more about yourself and what you're building. And that is the, you know, kind of intro to let you run with whatever direction you want.
And ideally, is that response a minute or two? Like maybe 30 seconds? It's
you know, I think it depends, but some people will give like a quick background and then they'll want to jump into the deck, and that's fine with me. If they want to give like a quick summary, that's also fine with me. I will say one of the things that I tend to do, which is different from a lot of other investors, and I get a lot of feedback on this, I typically do ask for a product demo if they have a product within the first meeting. And I think some founders are taken aback by that. They're like, oh, whoa, like I'm not ready, or, you know, no one's asked me that, or, you know, that's usually a couple meetings in from now. And I'm like, no. I really deeply want to understand what you've built, what you're aiming to build, and what customers are seeing, because I think seeing is believing.
It's also an opportunity to really wow you. It's not rooted in like trying to disprove something. It's like, I want to just see the excitement of what this is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, most of the time, what I found is founders are ecstatic to do it because that's what they've been spending all their time thinking about, living and breathing. And so it's a fun way to ask questions and really get a sense for what a customer would experience.
I love that. And so after that meeting, if it went well, how would you describe it to your partners? Like, what are the attributes that you would typically be like, this is why this is interesting?
Yeah. So typically what we would do is we try to circle up as a team every week to talk about, you know, startups that we're meeting with. And typically what I would do is I'd take the deck, notes from the meeting, and I would try to distill into kind of the three big topic areas. One, team, which is most critical, I think, at pre-seed and seed. Two, the product, which is really important to us. Other pre-seed and seed investors, I think, have different points of view because the product tends to change. But I think it's a good early indicator about what founders are trying to build and the vision that they have. And then three is the market. And I think that's actually potentially one of the toughest areas at pre-seed and seed, because what you want to do is build for a specific market that's super enthusiastic about the product. But oftentimes that market might seem smaller because you're trying to like really hone in on a ideal customer profile. Whereas obviously, as you think about the product as it evolves, you're trying to get to a market size that would be exciting for Series A investors. And what we've typically seen is at least a $10 billion type market size, and oftentimes even more for larger funds. And so you have this interesting tension where you want founders to be disciplined and thoughtful and really understand a unique subset of customers, but you also want this product to apply to a much larger world. And I do think that there is times a tension and a tightrope to walk there, but the best founders will evangelize that really well and give you the kind of roadmap and vision that they have.
So it's selling the beachhead that you're on now.
Yeah.
And how it connects to the broader $10 billion plus market. And that is always a tension, but you got to be able to play that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Founder Initiative Podcast. I'm Adam O'Donnell, and this is all about helping founders hit product market fit, get funded, and stay up to date. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. Boom.